Welcome to the Court of Appeals. This is the second of our two oral arguments. And of course, we're appearing in the Zoom format. Judges Johnson and Hooten joining me, Judge Sleater presiding in case number two. The case is file number 821-1268, Charles Ray Ferguson, petitioner appellant versus Sherry Ferguson, the respondent. And so, counsel, you should both, by the way, first, I apologize for our delay. We had a number of overtime questions in the previous matter. And so, hence our start time delayed by almost 22 minutes or so. So, thank you for your patience. So, counsel, when you do proceed with your statements, would you please identify yourself and whom you represent for the record? You should see a clock in the corner of your screen somewhere. And so, if for some reason we lose you for technological reasons, the marshal knows to pause the clock until we get reconnected. So, with those comments in mind, counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Attorney Jacob Burkholz here for appellant Charles Ferguson. And I did have the pleasure of listening to the last argument, and it was very interesting. I'm not sure this is quite so interesting, but I think I'll do my best to keep it simple and to the point. Should my client have been sanctioned for bringing a motion, a singular motion? I don't really think the facts are too much in dispute, at least as big picture. I was underlying trial counsel. The parties met on a single occasion and settled in a very brief delineated mediated agreement. They had that happen. My client then had consulted with his elder law attorney and said, based on the language of the stipulation, that the transfer of the funds as requested would trigger a penalty, and that penalty was significant. And I want to be clear, there's some perhaps ambiguity in the record. Is it exactly 8,000? I don't know. I don't think we know the exact penalty. I think it's just an estimated amount that was an offer of proof provided by myself, by Mr. Casper, provided an affidavit for the court. This is not a speculative situation. And so
with this penalty, there's nothing in the record that indicates that one way or another, whether it could be challenged, is there? I mean, it seems like, what you're basically saying is that there's a penalty if the funds transfer 1 minute before the judgment decree is there's no penalty if it's transferred before the judgment and decree is executed, but the minute that judgment decree is executed and a judgment entered, then there's a penalty. Is that your understanding? I mean, yes. But is there anything in the record that indicates that could be challenged under the circumstances of this case, where it's clear it was to be simultaneous, that this payment was to be simultaneous with that signing?
No, I don't think that's accurate either, but I think I gave him maybe 10 days to make the payment, or, you know, obviously a transfer of funds.
Whatever. It's not on the exact day, but simultaneous with the signing.
That
this is a different situation.
Not at all. I mean, from a standpoint that this was speculative or something, the court didn't make that finding. That would be, again, a fact finding by this court. In fact, the court simply just said, no, it was reasonable to address this issue. And that was kind of the irony, is that the district court said, no, it was very reasonable to negotiate this piece, but somehow unreasonable to bring the motion and make this contradictory finding. To your point, Your Honor, the state of Minnesota is not, at least my experience, is not a situation where you're going to be able to negotiate a fact which is not in dispute, meaning if this was left unchallenged, the decree would operate would be mandatory, and his prohibition of receiving funds post-divorce as a single person is very clear, at least under the eligibility manual and an expert attorney and Nicola County Human Services, that this will trigger a penalty because of his IFP status. He was actually IFP to the district court. He was living in housing and receiving state benefits. So I don't think there's really any dispute, nor does a respondent dispute, that he was IFP and that this penalty would be triggered. So whether or not it could conceivably be moderated, I think the question then is it wrong to bring to this court a motion to avoid a penalty that was at least clear to be?
Well, and I guess my question is, I mean, is there anything in this record that says no matter what, with no ability to challenge it, there will be a penalty? Is there anything in this record that supports that proposition?
I don't have it open in front of me, but I'd rely on the Minnesota Eligibility Manual and Casper's affidavit. I don't think that's clear because we never got there. And so I'd have to make arguments to the court outside the record.
And I don't want you to do that because we're obviously confined by this record.
So that's the record. And I think that I try to go back through in my brief and in my reply brief, like, well, what's the standard? I mean, first of all, the district court did not make adequate findings for this court to review. That's number one, that somehow this justifies conduct-based fees. The facts are clear that this was a singular motion on an entire divorce case. That's very limited. And so this kind of argument that it was an unnecessary extension. And I also want to be clear in my reply brief that there seems to be an argument that is erroneously made at oral argument at the motion hearing by respondents' counsel that simply attempts to say that this was all a non-ambiguous mediated agreement. And I make clear in my reply, the actual language that's proposed is not in the mediated agreement. And essentially, they're forcing a provision on Mr. Ferguson that is not clearly mediated. And so I think that that's another layer here from a contractual perspective. We're being forced. This isn't this kind of unilateral mistake environment. And so I perhaps didn't push that hard enough because I've never seen a district court actually deny a similar motion that I've ever made in my entire career until now, which is why it's being appealed. These are very, unfortunately, normal proceedings when you have situations that arise. What happens if a party has unexpected circumstances, fraud, lack of disclosure, 518-145 motions are not unusual. And so what are we left with? So if you kind
Mr. Burkholz, before you go on, it seems to me that your motion would contradict paragraph 3 of the mediation agreement, which says that wife could mail a check within 10 days after the signature. Maybe most importantly, the sentence saying husband's attorney will not distribute those funds until the entry of the decree. Isn't it true that the motion you wanted to change the date of distribution of funds so that it was before the date of the decree in, you know, in contrary to that sentence in paragraph 3.
You're referring to the exact language of the decree. I was trying to provide all options to the district court, if that's what you're referring to.
I'm looking at the mediation agreement, which is at page 4 of your addendum, the one-page mediation agreement signed by the parties and their lawyers. And I guess I'm going back to your statement that your motion sought to change the agreement by adding language, only by adding language. I thought that was your argument. And it seems to me that your motion would have contradicted that one sentence in paragraph 3 about the date of the distribution of funds.
I think it's an interpretation, right? It says within 10 days of receiving the signature. That's critical. It doesn't say, right, that entry of the decree.
Well, that's the date that wife shall mail the check to the husband's attorney.
Right.
And then, but then a couple of sentences later, one sentence later, it says husband's attorney will not distribute those funds until the entry of the decree.
Absolutely. They're still in my trust account.
But that's what you wanted to change, right? You wanted to change the date of the distribution?
No. I just wanted to clarify to avoid the argument of counsel. Counsel attempts to obfuscate this many, many times by saying this was our agreement. That's not what it says. And that's why the language, which I then put in my reply brief, that they add this language and her demands are outside the mediated agreement. And then her additional language was not clear. So is there an ambiguity? At a minimum, there's an ambiguity. So we sign the stipulation and I just say, no, we need to have this real estate transferred and the funds move according to the information. Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that transfer, and I assume the signing of the quitclaim deed, isn't that covered under 5, paragraph 5 of the mediation agreement, which it says each party will sign the documents necessary to effectuate the settlement herein?
Yeah, they refused because this is, let's put it into a different context. Of course, we wanted to, and I supplied that in my reply brief. Mr. Ferguson was always willing. We were always willing to get this deal done. So this idea that if the court's reading language in that says, I have to transfer all of this post-decree, that's not in the mediated agreement. And so, and this is the part that it frustrates me, is that the proposed decree language was always is not clear within. So I bring language to make it clear that we can do this process. And that's why I reference the question of the district court to opposing counsel at oral argument, which was, what's the prejudice here? And there was none. The only thing that was cited, and I quote in my reply brief from opposing counsel, is, well, he's going to be in contempt of the agreement. And I said, that's contrary to every email and every phone. Well, I didn't have phone calls. Every email and correspondence. We're willing to follow this through. I just need to accommodate this penalty transfer. And in fact, the check gets mailed to our office, right? In good faith. And I keep it in my trust account in good faith. We're operating in a good faith environment. These funds are not dispersed. I never dispersed the funds to Mr. Ferguson. So this argument that she says that Mr. Ferguson is going to somehow run away with the money and not do the deal is just obfuscated and inconsistent with every fact in the record. Keep in mind, what was the scenario in the petition and the decree? Mr. Ferguson had been out of the house since 2013. That's why this case was very unique, because he didn't have the house. He was getting a settlement check.
I mean, she doesn't have to. I mean, she's just, I mean, the fact that she wants the judgment and decree signed, it doesn't mean that she has to show that there's some reason for that other than she wants finality. I mean, I don't think, and that's the deal they reached. I don't know how the husband's attorney would be able to transfer these funds and not be in violation of the agreement if it's done before the signing or the entry of the decree of dissolution.
Well, I'm not sure what that has to do with the motion, what we brought. We said that we needed this real estate transferred so that he wouldn't be penalized prior to the exchange. So I don't want the court to be confused that somehow the money in my trust account was the issue. So the equity in this exchange, so they say, we're not doing this. And I say, no, we got the money in the trust account, that's fine. So we can't have this asset linked to him. And they say, well, we're not doing a transfer prior to the decree. And that assumes a huge error that I am going to directly violate our agreement. And I said, that's unbelievable that every argument that this would be a mandatory anticipatory repudiation that I'm going to be in contempt of the court's order and so will Mr. Ferguson. And that's, first of all, it's not in the decree clearly. And that when this issue comes up, it is reasonable to bring it up to the court to manage the timing issue. And so I've never seen, I shouldn't say never, but this issue was unique in the sense that we needed to do the transfer prior to the decree. It's interesting that a marital lien was actually proposed as a solution by opposing counsel, but then refused to do it. If you read the oral argument, we had the solution and I said, let's do it. And she says, no. And so this is where it comes in that actually this, it is a projected argument that opposing counsel should actually be in my chair, but instead the court followed her argument. Meaning, is it unreasonable for her to insert terms into the decree and then presume a violation that didn't occur and then refuse and extend the proceedings when all that needed to happen was we changed the language to do a marital lien? And she is fully protected. And I said, she says that in oral argument. And I said, what in the world are we doing here? I said, let's just do that. We can preserve rights and transfer assets and prevent this entire problem. But opposing counsel in her emails continues to say, no, I'm not doing anything. Puts an ironclad wall and says, we follow the mediated agreement. I said, well, what am I supposed to do for Mr. Ferguson? Add terms to a mediated agreement to penalize my own client? That puts me into a situation where the court mandates me to commit malpractice in order to follow an ambiguous decree. And then I'm in turn to sit, turn to my malpractice carrier and turn this over and say, no, I bring a motion to court to clarify the issue. And so the bottom line argument is, what standard does an attorney have when faced with a difficult decision such as this, to bring a motion or to essentially concede all reasonable arguments that I've raised to this court, interpretation of the language, timing of the decree, prejudice, the amount of the penalty, all reasonable arguments. And then to assume that those reasonable arguments fall to a standard so low that they justify conduct-based fees. And I did my darndest also to try and find some case law for this court, and I did in my reply memorandum, to highlight what would be a situation such as this, a non-extended proceeding, non-motion issue. And I found that the language is this: the conduct has to be frivolous, in bad faith, or unreasonable. And in fact, the district court found it to be reasonable, and the district court never made a finding of frivolousness or bad faith by Mr. Ferguson or his counsel, myself. So certainly this court would then have to remand to the district court to make those specific findings if the court found that it justified. And I don't believe they can. Thank you. I see my time's up.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. So counsel for respondent, if you would identify yourself, then you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Schabel with Grindy and Dickey Law Firm, and we represent respondent Sherry Ferguson. Your Honors, appellant is here today asking this court to find that the district court abused its discretion in awarding conduct-based attorney fees against appellant. Now, the issue of ambiguity, while it provides context, but that specific determination by the district court is not up for appeal. Now, in order for this court to find that the district court abused its discretion in awarding conduct-based attorney fees, this court would have to find that the district court's decision was against all logic and facts on record. I do want to refute one of appellant's statements. Respondent does dispute the penalty. And if you look at Mr. Casper's affidavit, he states that there could be a concern of a potential penalty. He also notes that there is a process to challenge decisions, but that requires going through the administrative appellate process or administrative hearing. Attorney Casper, in his affidavit, includes an email exchange with county workers regarding this issue, but they're not very easy to follow. And one of the workers ultimately says, oh, I guess if this is occurring after the dissolution, it would be okay. There's not a discussion of what other alternatives are there. Are there other exceptions that apply? There's not even a clear determination by the county workers in this email exchange that, yes, in fact, if this exchange occurs before the entry of the decree, Mr. Ferguson will suffer penalties. So there was never any evidence that there would, in fact, be a penalty or what the penalty amount is. And that is one of the reasons why the district court found appellant's motion to be unreasonable. It is not respondent's position that no party may ever bring a motion during litigation. However, if a party is coming to the court with a motion, they must provide law in support of their position, or at least a colorable argument that the law supports their position. And they also must present facts in support of their position. And here, that did not happen. And that is why the district court ultimately determined that, quote, appellant's insistence on bringing the motion was, quote, unreasonable and contributed to the length and expense of the proceeding for wife. And that specific determination is the specific finding that a district court must make in order to support an attorney fee award. The finding has been made.
Can I interrupt you for a moment? Because apparently what was added and does not exist in the immediate agreement is that the quitclaim deed conveying husband's interest in the property to wife has to be signed immediately upon entry of the judgment and decree. Is that a fair statement? But that was not part of the mediation as to the timing of the quitclaim deed. It just says that they'll sign. So,
Your Honor, the mediated settlement agreement does indicate that the parties will sign the documents necessary. This particular mediated settlement agreement cannot be the full and final decree, but that is, courts have a purpose here. This is not just some contract between the parties. In dissolution actions, courts are interested persons under Minnesota law in the provisions of the decree. But the quitclaim deed and the timing of that's not at issue here. There are Minnesota title standards that affect spouses' interests in property. And there are legal reasons why quitclaim deeds are done after a decree has been entered. Because a quitclaim deed is signed before the decree is entered, there's still a legal interest that exists that still has to be cleared up after the decree and when the property is sold. But here, the district court found that a number of issues with appellant's position, which made it unreasonable and which justified the attorney fee award. Appellant is presenting a strained construction of the mediated settlement agreement. Judge Johnson, you are correct. The language is unambiguous. Husband's attorney will not distribute those funds until the entry of the decree of dissolution herein. That's the issue. That's the language that appellant wants changed. It was not ambiguous. And so the court cannot, under contract theory, under theory of ambiguity, change that language if there's no ambiguity. Now, appellant can present and did present a request for equitable relief that there was going to be this burden that in the interest of justice, the court should modify the agreement. But
was your understanding, though, that the request was to amend both 3 and 5, I guess, in with regard to the timing of the mediated agreement. Is that your understanding?
My understanding is that appellant used, read ambiguity into the provisions regarding the transfer of real and personal property and attempted to use that ambiguity to make the entire agreement ambiguous. If I go back to his notice of motion, I do think he asked for additional relief, but in my opinion, that is just an attempt to persuade the district court to find ambiguity in the provision concerning the property settlement payment, because that was what was of concern to them. So they needed that specific language changed. And even though there's not ambiguity there, they wanted to persuade the court that there's ambiguity elsewhere in the documents. Just extend that so that the entire agreement can be modified.
Ms. Shable, you referenced equity, and that's kind of the focus I wanted to ask you about, and what role that plays in our appellate review. And that is, we know that all property distribution in length, and remedies in a family court proceeding is equitable. And it seems like here, when the court reasonably said that the request was reasonable, it's because there's at a minimum, it looks like a likelihood of a penalty, which therefore obviously creates an inequitable intended distribution as set forth in the mediated agreement. Now, I know that part of it's not before us, but what is before us is the conduct-based attorney's fees that is unreasonable and extended. And I'm having a little hard time when maybe the request was poorly worded, and you make some good points. The contract law we know is applied in family law, yet the remedy in family law is equitable, whereas in most contract, unless there's an equitable remedy sought, is not. And so though it could not be reformed, and maybe it should have been worded simply different with an admission, look, it's unambiguous. And this gets to the other relief requested. We agree it's unambiguous, but it's creating an inequitable property distribution. Therefore, we request some remedy from the court. Do you agree that the court could have, provided such a remedy, whether we call it a reformation or just simply change the date of a signature to avoid that possible penalty, could have done so. And so therefore, requesting that relief of the district court would not be itself unreasonable to support conduct-based attorney's fees.
And Judge Slater, I agree that a party may go to the district court to ask for equitable relief, but the party must support that request with, if there's not law, then facts. And here the district court made a specific finding that appellant had not presented any factual evidence about the amount of penalty. And so the standard is, will there be an oppressive burden on the one seeking rescission? Appellant couldn't show that there would be an oppressive burden. And the substantial hardship to respondent is the situation where, consider the context, appellant has serious health issues. Appellant can't make the motion hearing because of those serious health conditions. If the property transfer is made, is a very large sum of money, over $67,000 and some change. Property settlement is made. Appellant, his health spirals, or some expected expense occurs. He wants more money. So he tells his attorney, Attorney Burkholz, I'm reneging. I don't want to sign this. Attorney Burkholz says, you signed this. You need to go through with it. They can bring you to court and attempt to enforce this agreement. Appellant says, I don't like what you're telling me. You're fired. I'm going with a new attorney. I want to relitigate everything. That's the concern. It happened once. There was a mediated settlement agreement. He didn't like the outcome of it. He had been seeking cash payment beforehand, didn't get it in the mediated settlement agreement, couldn't provide any kind of reassurance to respondents other than, we'll sign a quick claim deed earlier. It won't address the title issues, but it's something, right? He just says, we'll follow the order. He didn't follow the mediated settlement agreement. Couldn't produce evidence that there would, in fact, be a penalty or that there was any reassurance. If he received that $67,000, it could be recovered. That money, if he spent it, it was going to be gone. And she was not, he's IFP. She wasn't going to be able to recover it from him. So that is a serious risk for our client. She's lost that money. She could potentially have to, she either has to go to court to try and enforce this agreement, or she has to relitigate every issue. So she did not agree to modify. And again, because appellant couldn't provide law in support of his arguments, he asserted there weren't any cases related to the issue. The district court made a footnote questioning that assertion, but giving counsel the benefit of the doubt. But if you consider all of this context, there's no law, there's no colorable argument that this particular provision is ambiguous, and there's no facts. If that's not an unreasonable, frivolous, bad faith motion, what is? And so, for all those reasons, the district court was justified in awarding the attorney fee in favor of respondent. Your honors can look at the billing statements to determine if they're reasonable or not. The district court found that they were. The district court noted in his December 21st, 2020 order that even the court had spent a significant time researching these issues. It's respondent's position that the work, the fees were appropriate, permitted by Minnesota law, and they should stand. And so respondent respectfully requests that this court affirm the district court's December 11th and December 21st, 2020 orders. Thank you.
Was it necessary for you and your client to file a counter motion? In other words, why could you not have just simply opposed the motion brought by Mr. Ferguson and Mr. Burkholz?
Your Honor, the reason why a counter motion was filed was to ensure that the agreement was effectuated and that the divorce was finalized. There wasn't an expectation that appellant would sign the proposed decree. It had been sitting over ready for appellant's signature for months. That had been sent over in February with the check. And that was the only way respondent could get finality, is if the court approved of the decree.
Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, counsel for respondent. Counsel for appellant, you will now have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to clarify. I had to pull up my motion. There seems to be some confusion either by the district court and opposing counsel as to what actually was raised. If you look at my motion, it's actually very clear. It actually isn't exactly what's being stated either by the district court or opposing counsel. Item one of my motion says interpreting and enforcing the mediated agreement and having the exchange of property and the deed occur prior to the decree. So this is, then the district court in its memo spends all this unnecessary time talking about this clear language of the property distribution, the money transfer. I think the critical issue, if you actually read Casper's affidavit, so this idea that there aren't facts, is the court has to presume facts to be true. I mean, that's consistent with essentially like the Niece-Peterson standard and all family law. As far as I'm concerned, that is a presumption of a fact, is a statement from Casper under oath, who's I would consider an expert family law attorney. To say there isn't a fact referencing Minnesota law and confirmation of the county, if that's not a fact, I don't know what is, at least for purposes of a motion hearing, arguing that there's a good faith basis for it. Then if you look at the motion, it actually says, I'm seeking enforcement of it as well, but clarifying their interpretation is incorrect. So this idea that I'm bringing this clear argument is simply a farce. It never existed. A party can't simply say, well, it's clear, you can just do what I want, and then add terms, as Your Honor, Judge Hooten provided. This quick claim deed is critical. This idea that counsel now interprets and adds more alleged facts into the record about an ECRV, or excuse me, the timing of the recording of the deed, actually, if you understand real estate property title standards, is part of the problem, which is addendum page 15, about this, that the fair market value, it is the real estate deed transfer. Minnesota law actually under the title standards will trigger by the operation of law when, as this court noted, unfortunately, the decree separates the bonds of matrimony, which is then going to trigger a mandatory at the time you sign the quitclaim deed that you're single. And so this is going to trigger the problem by law. And I said, look, we got an issue and we have solutions. And so this concept that I'm bringing a frivolous motion to obviate the decree is actually incorrect. I'm trying to get this done, and opposing counsel stands in the way and says, oh, no, it's not a problem. It's your problem. And so we become, who's creating this impasse? So I'm trying to, in good faith, number one, deal and talk with an expert. And so I get the expert, I present the problem, and then it's rebuffed. And then we come back. And so this idea that now it's being retaliatory and saying, no, you have to take a penalty by accepting my language or else. So is that something? Yes.
In order to accomplish what you want to accomplish, this $67,500 must be paid before the entry of the judgment decree. Am I correct?
I'm not sure. And so I think
it isn't that what you asked for?
Alternatively, yes.
I'm following up on Judge Johnson's initial question to you. Isn't this contrary to the unambiguous language of paragraph 3 of the mediated agreement?
No. I'm not sure about it. Because it says it stays in my trust account. So the issue, the transfer, is where, and it can stay there, because the transfer comes in when it hits the party. And so, at least as I'm trying not to violate this, and so this triggering event, and this is where it also cascades into the problem of opposing counsel saying that somehow she's harmed. I thought I heard that again. Remember, Mr. Ferguson is taking far less than an equitable share of the actual fair market value of the house in order to settle the claims. So she's keeping everything, keeping her retirement, keeping all the assets. So where is this argument that Mr. Ferguson's going to run off with her money? That would actually be inconsistent with all the facts in the record. I just want to make that clear, is that she retains it all except for the money she paid into my trust account, which was always there. So this idea that this argument of Mr. Ferguson running away and restarting this case, I had the money in my trust account. So if there's an issue with Mr. Ferguson not signing, I can send the check back. And so again, I'm trying to find a solution. As the court noted, I'm trying to come up with equitable relief. I'm trying to get opposing counsel to the table. All that was required was the court to say, counsel, sit down, try and work out this timing issue, and we wouldn't be here.
Mr. Burkholz, what would have happened if your client had simply executed the quitclaim deed shortly after the mediation, before signing the formal document, the stipulation, and before the J&D?
Meaning, should I have had him send a...
Well, what would have happened?
Well, she could have signed it. Is that what you mean? Like, she might have signed it if I sent it? Because she has to sign it.
But, well, your client's had an obligation to execute a quitclaim deed. What if he just went ahead and did it before signing the stipulation? What would have happened then?
I feel like I'd be brought here on another motion saying I'm violating this alleged interpretation of the decree. I don't know what timing you're thinking of. I'm just looking back at the mediated agreement. If I'm just supposed to sign a document, it just says sign all necessary documents. In fact, the mediated agreement doesn't reference one. So if I think what I'm hearing Your Honor say is, if I'm trying to effectuate my own position by showing a good faith effort of having him sign the quitclaim deed in advance.
It's a hypothetical question, and I think you've answered it adequately, so I appreciate that.
Okay. Yep. I see my time is up.
I see no other questions. I appreciate both counsels. We appreciate both counsels' answer to our questions and your briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement. And